But first, Michael Imperioli. You probably remember him for his outstanding portrayal of Tony Soprano's protege, Christopher Moltisanti, on The Sopranos. But Michael is not just an Emmy Award-winning actor. He was also the only Sopranos cast member to join creator David Chase's writing room. He wrote several popular episodes of the show, and writing is still in his blood. Michael has just released his debut novel. It's called The Perfume Burned His Eyes. The novel takes place in New York in the 70s. It's about a Queens teenager named Matthew who moves to Manhattan. After having trouble adjusting, he finds help from an unlikely source. It turns out that rock icon Lou Reed lives in the very same building. Lou befriends Matthew and helps him find his way in a strange dynamic world. Michael has written a gripping, propulsive, and somewhat Salinger-esque novel. He joined us from his home in New York to talk about the book, his friendship with Lou Reed, and his love affair with writing.
I had made several attempts at fiction, mostly short stories, none of which were any good. But fiction had been a love of mine for quite a long time. And a friend of mine, who's also a fellow fiction writer, said to me one day, "When are you going to write a novel?" Like, I can't write a novel. And he said, "No, you could write a novel." And for some bizarre reason, I actually believed him. And then when my middle child was 16, he was going through the usual and unusual 16-year-old things. And I wanted to find a way to relate to that mind. So I started writing this coming-of-age story. And this was mid-2013. And I set it in New York in the 70s out of a fondness for the era, really. I was 11 when this story kind of starts. And I started writing. And then in October of that year, Lou Reed died. And which hit me on a number of levels. As a fan, as an artist, as a New Yorker, and as a friend, because I got to be friendly with Lou in the last dozen years of his life. And I had been in touch with him a little bit in the last month of his life. And somehow I got the idea of, okay, the kid moves from Queens to New York and he lives in Lou's building in 1977. And that was how it started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned earlier that part of the reason you were inspired to write this novel was to kind of get in touch with your middle son, who was 16 at the time. I'm curious to know, has he read your novel?
Yeah, he was one of the first readers outside of my wife, and he liked it a lot.
That's great to hear. And yeah, and why wouldn't he like it a lot? It's a great novel. After you talked about this earlier, about Matthew and his mother moving from Jackson Heights, Queens, to Manhattan, and then Matthew discovers that Lou Reed lives in the same apartment building. You touched on it earlier, but I want to ask you more directly. Why did you decide to include Lou as a character in your book?
Mostly out of my great admiration for him. Mm-hmm. And he's been kind of a North Star for me in terms of navigating my own artistic life. And he became very important to me. And when he died, I really felt something had ended. Like an era had really ended for me and for New York and for the music world. And part of me liked the idea of spending time with him in my mind, you know, for quite a long time. And it was, I was correct in that impulse because I did enjoy having that, opening that space and being with him there. Even though the Lou of 1977 was very different than the Lou that I finally befriended in 2001.
What was the difference between...
He was a raging drug addict, alcoholic in the 70s, to the point where he was really the rock star that everyone thought was going to die, more so than like Keith Richards. Lou was he was shooting Dizoxin, which is like an amphetamine I think they gave to like heart attack victims or something, you know, and he'd be up for days and all the psychosis that comes with that. And then in the 80s, he got married to his second wife, Sylvia Morales, and she helped him get sober and also started managing his career and moved him into this other stage of his life where he became very creative and started putting out some really mature works that were very relevant and really potent works of art, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you had this friendship with Lou Reed. Do you have a favorite memory of your friendship with him that you treasure and think about more than any other memory?
A very funny story. The first time I met Lou was way before we became friends. It was around 1991 or two. And I had lived in the Village since I was 21 or 22, Greenwich Village, where Lou lived at the time. And I would see him walking around the Village, you know, which was very odd seeing like your heroes just wandering around your same neighborhood that you lived in. But I never had the courage to approach him. And then one day I was at a Knicks game. And Lou is at the Knicks game. And at the time, I had just been cast in a movie called I Shot Andy Warhol. And I was playing Ondine, one of the Warhol superstars, who was also a very good friend of Lou Reed's. So I'm like, this is a great icebreaker. I can walk up to Lou, say I'm a big fan, I'm playing one of your friends. Great way to open a conversation. The problem was, and I knew this was a risk, I Shot Andy Warhol was about Valerie Solanas, who shot and, you know, almost killed one of Lou's best friends, Andy Warhol. So I knew he wasn't happy. He had been vocal that he was not happy they were making this movie. But I took the risk and I went up to him and I said, my name is Michael. I'm an actor. I know I just got cast in this movie. I know you're really not happy. They're making it. I Shot Andy Warhol. And he goes, I think it's despicable they're making a movie about that psychotic bitch. I said, yeah, I know. But I'm doing it anyway. And I'm playing someone who you knew. His name was Ondine. And he went, good luck. And he turned away, walked away, and went on the escalator, which leads out of the garden. The game was over. And I was just devastated. I felt like such a fool, you know. And I'm on the escalator, and he's several steps ahead of me. And he looks over his shoulder, and he looks back at me a couple of times, and he waves me over to him. And I walked up to him, and he put his arm around me and said, listen, work hard, do a good job, and just remember one thing. He was very funny, and that was it. And in some ways, that little scene really was a seed and a germ for the relationship between Matthew and Lou in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The artist and musician Laurie Anderson was married to Lou Reed for 5 years. Has she read your novel?
Yeah, I read it to her before I published it, and I wrote to her and said, that I was writing it. I wanted her to know from me that I was writing it, that it wasn't something that is based in the biographical background is true. He lived in that neighborhood in a building there with Rachel Humphreys and obviously was doing drugs, but the relationship and the events in the book are not true. Mm-hmm. And I said, I just want you to know, I wrote this out of a place of love and admiration and respect. If you don't want to read it, I get it. If you do want to read it and want to share your thoughts, you can. If you read it and don't want to share your thoughts, that's fine. But I just wanted you to know that I'm doing it and where it comes from. I would not have published it while he was alive. Hmm. And she read it and she wrote back and she said she liked it. She said she saw some Louisms, but she said, to be honest, I didn't know Lou at that time.
Right.
So to me, you know, that character was very different than the Lou that I know. I didn't know that character. But his second wife, Laurie was his third wife. His second wife, Sylvia Morales, did know him at that time and kind of thought, was under the impression that it was a true story.
Are you happier as a brunette?
Are you happier as a schmuck?
I'm no schmuck.
I'm no brunette.
You were blonde last time, though.
No, I wasn't.
You were?
I was a bleached blonde.
A bleached blonde.
Trashy blonde.
You looked younger as a blonde.
Well, you look older.
I'm not a blonde, though.
I know, it's worse.
Listen.
You don't stand a chance. You're going to dig your own grave.
I know, I'm not trying to fight you.
Ask us a nice, reasonable question instead of, you know, who do you date? You know.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, but you were the only Sopranos cast member who wrote scripts for the show. How did David Chase's writing room compare to your novel writing experience?
One of the motivating factors towards writing a novel was I had had several, at least three or four TV series projects that were in various stages of development with studios and networks, but never made it to the air for a variety of different reasons. But most of it had to do with, you know, having to find a way to make it fit into the network or studio's agenda. And I found it very, very frustrating.
You ever feel like nothing good was ever going to happen to you?
Yeah, and nothing did. So what? I'm alive. I'm surviving.
That's it. I don't want to just survive. It says in these movie writing books that every character has an arc. You understand? Like everybody starts out somewheres, and then they do something, something gets done to them, changes their life. That's called their arc. Where's my arc?
But, you know, screenplays and teleplays are not works unto themselves. They're blueprints, they're schematics. Once you make the actual show, they're worthless. And until you make the actual show, they're kind of worthless. And I said, well, if I write a book, it's an end unto itself. I mean, obviously you need a publisher to put it out, but the work itself is, that's the work. It's not waiting for some producer to greenlight it, to get a budget so you can cast it and hire a crew and shoot it and then edit it. It is the work. And most of my writing before that was very collaborative. TV and film is a very collaborative medium for a writer. And some of the projects I wrote in tandem with other writers. And there was something about the isolation and solitary qualities of writing a novel that at that time really appealed to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Speaking of The Sopranos, you launched a podcast which breaks down each episode. What has that experience been like?
We did that from April of 2020 till December of 21. Talking Sopranos podcast, which was an episode by episode rewatch. Steve Sciarrapa and I did it together. And neither one of us had watched The Sopranos since it went off the air in 2007. Hmm. And now we had to rewatch the entire series week by week. And not only watch it, but I mean, I would take 20 pages of notes, you know.
Wow.
Every single pop culture reference, every song, every guest actor, locations. I would look up everything that went into that.
In the writer's room, you'll outline it together with the other writers or just one writer with
David. Oh, you will. So yeah. You had, so even though
I didn't
you...
with this episode.
Okay. What do you say your spec script that you turned in, how much do you think wind up being used?
Quite a bit, actually.
75%, 80%?
Maybe, because wow, the A story really is Christopher and the afterlife and the stuff with Paulie, all that stuff was in. Obviously, the stuff with hunting down Matt Bevilacqua, that wasn't in there. The vasectomy wasn't in there. So those were storylines that David had broken, and then he gave them to me. And then you go off with an outline and write a first draft.
And I was really, really blown away by how good it was and how well it held up. And the show, the podcast gave me a real new appreciation for it with some distance. Because when you're, you know, when you're making it and you're involved in it, there's so many personal things that you don't have much of an objectivity because there's so much personal stuff involved in your involvement and how you're dealing with it and what you're doing. And this was with, you know, 13 years of distance. And I was really able to kind of watch and understand why it has held up and has so many fans.
That's great to hear. Yeah. Yeah. What's next for you? Any plans to write another novel?
I'm writing a few things. I am writing another novel.
Great.
About 2/3 of the way into it.
Excellent.
I had to put it on hold for a couple other projects that came into my life. One is a TV pilot that are for HBO that I'm writing, and one is a film that I'm writing with David Chase. So those three things are in progress. My band has just finished recording a new album. We have to mix it in a couple of weeks. And the paperback version of this, Perfume Burn His Eyes, comes out in tandem with a book of Zopa lyrics that Akashic, our publisher, is putting out at the same time as the paperback release.
Oh, cool. So lots to look forward to. Can you tell us anything about the HBO TV pilot or the film you're working on with David Chase? Or
the TV pilot is with Alec Berg, who's a writer, producer, director, one of the showrunners of Barry on HBO, and also wrote produced Silicon Valley and wrote on Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And it's a half hour dark comedy where I play myself, and it explores celebrity and my, you know, kind of my own journey into Buddhism and things like, and spirituality. The movie, David and I are writing it, and it would star myself and Steve Sciarrippa.
Excellent. Michael Imperioli, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. Congratulations on The Perfume Burned His Eyes. It's a great book, and looking forward to your future projects.
Thank you for having me today.
Michael Imperioli is a novelist, screenwriter, musician, and actor. His debut novel is called The Perfume Burned His Eyes. You can find out more about Michael and his book at wpr.org/beta.
There's very few people in the world that would take an idea from a 20-year-old that's as crazy as this and actually run with it. And so I just kind of like love the spirit of that, where it's like Todd took a swing on it, on this kid, and that's the spirit of this whole show.
Coming up, director Andrew Renzi on the Netflix docuseries, Pepsi, Where's My Jet? I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.